The Progressive Commentary Hour with Gary Knoll, Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we are taking on the topic of globalization. We have a panel set from around the world to discuss this in some depth. Time permitting, we will also invite you to call in and share your questions and points of view. The Progressive Commentary Hour is an important platform, a forum for individuals to share points of view on a specific topic. I've selected globalization because all the candidates running believe in globalization and free trade and free markets. They say that this is important for creating jobs. The President of the United States is a major advocate of globalization. In fact, has gone on a junket to India to try to promote even more trade with India and with China and other countries. The major media has been strongly supportive of globalization and free market. In fact, when Ron Paul recently suggested that he would change the way that we do our trade, he was considered a hyper-nationalist, someone who wanted to cause jobs in America and cause us problems by not engaging in this. I believe that all of these are concepts that should be challenged. My panelist to help in this discussion will be Dr. Jim Garrison. He is the co-founder and president of Wisdom University, and as the co-founder and president of the Gorbachev Foundation, Jim was instrumental in the founding of the State of the World Forum, which generated a global network of leaders and visionaries from all walks of life to define a template for a more sustainable global civilization. In 2000, he initiated the launch of the Commission on Globalization, which challenged the existing global governance system and gathered leaders together to define viable alternatives. The World Forum is now dedicated to tackling the environmental and social problems related to climate change and global warming. He's a graduate in religion and theology from Harvard University and Cambridge Universities. Among his books are Civilization and the Transformation of Power, America's Empire, Global Leader or Rogue Nation, and his forthcoming book will be addressing climate change and the return of Gaia. Joining him will be Dr. Tony Clark. Dr. Clark is a Canadian activist and director of the Polaris Institute, a nonprofit organization empowering citizens' movements to fight for democratic change in the midst of corporate-driven globalization. He was earlier the chair of the Action Canada Network supporting labor against the Canadian and U.S. Free Trade Agreement and is the vice chair of the Council of Canadians and a board member of the International Forum on Globalization and the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives. He is the recipient of the Right Livelihood Award along with Maud Barlow, who has appeared on this program several times and is the author of 10 books, including Tar Sands Showdown, Blue Gold, The Fight to Stop the Corporate Theft of the World Water, written with Maud Barlow. Tony has degrees from the University of British Columbia and a doctorate in religious studies from the University of Chicago. His website is PolarisInstitute.org. Now, we're having a little trouble reaching our third panelist. He is in the Philippines, and communications right now is not up to a standard that we can actually reach him. Hopefully, he will be able to be put on the program at some point. He is Professor Walden Bellow. He is an internationally renowned academic, political and economic analyst, environmentalist, human rights activist, and a forthright critic of the liberal market drive for globalization. Economist Naomi Klein called him the world's leading no-nonsense revolutionary. He received doctorates in sociology from Princeton University and later went on to become the founding director of Focus on Global South, a policy research institute based at the University of Thailand. He also sits as a member of Congress in the Philippines House of Representatives. And his political activism began in the Philippines in protesting the martial law of then-President Fernando Marcos. And he has been arrested repeatedly, including having been jailed in the U.S. for a nonviolent takeover of the Philippine consulate in San Francisco. And he was released after a hunger strike there to publicize human rights violations in his country. So he also won the Right Livelihood, which is the alternative Nobel Peace Prize, and was named in 2008 Outstanding Public Scholar by the International Studies Association. He has many books and research papers, including Deglobalization, Ideas for a New World Economy, and most recently, The Food Wars. I'd like to welcome all of our panelists, and let's begin with just a roundtable opening discussion on where do you believe that globalization has brought us? This is just a large open-ended question for each of you, and let's start with Jim Garrison. Jim, nice to have you with us today.
Nice to be back on the show, Gary. Hope all is well.
Yes.
I would say that globalization has brought the world to the brink of a global depression. I think if one just looks at the news over the last couple of weeks with Standard & Poor's downgrading nine European countries, last fall downgrading the United States of America, the warnings of the International Monetary Fund now, not only to third world countries and developing countries, but first world countries and developed countries, that the entire economic and financial infrastructure, literally of the planet, is on the verge of a systemic collapse. And I think when we talk about globalization, more and more we need to see that the ravages of globalization are not just on the developing world at the hands of the G8 and the multinational corporations, but the fact that these multinational corporations are now literally savaging the United States and Europe in many ways like they've been savaging the third world. And I think over the next couple of years, I think there's going to be a great reckoning in which the entire edifice of globalization may well collapse of its own weight.
All right. Thank you for that overview. Dr. Tony Clark, your overview of where you believe globalization has brought us at this time.
Well, I would just say ditto to what I heard Jim say. So I think you know, the promise of globalization, which was really about breaking down barriers so that corporations could move all over the world to move their capital, move their goods and services and all of that. And the liberalization that's gone with that has been a failed experiment. And it promised to lift all boats, and it's done exactly the opposite. The gap between rich and poor, just to take that one scale alone, has come to the point where you know, the gap has grown much larger, especially over the last 30 years. And what we've seen is a collapse, quite frankly, of the as Jim was saying, of the both the economic model itself and the financial system that's behind it. At the same time, what's happened is that it's blossomed into a series of global crises. We have the economic crises, we have the financial crises, and the meltdown that occurred in 2008 is continuing to the present time. This is compounded further by a climate crisis, which calls for dramatic changes in the way in which we the economic model needs to operate. It is further reinforced by a food crisis that is deepening in different parts of the world today. And with that, of course, comes a social crisis, and what we've seen with the Occupy Wall Street movement and the Arab Spring, all of which are indicators that there's a great deal of social unrest that's just unraveling underneath all of this. So I would say yes, we are faced with a failed experiment in terms of globalization. It's turned into a series of multiple global crises that are reinforcing one another. And then thirdly, coming out of this is the problem of global economic governance. We've seen the sort of casting aside of the G8 for very good reasons in many cases, but it's gone and to a large extent, and in its place is the G20. But the G20 really can't handle the kinds of crises that are just bubbling at the surface here. So I think we are at a very, very critical historical moment right now. And whether or not the system which we've known as global capitalism is going to continue, or whether it's going to continue to unravel to the point of collapse itself. And I think these are the critical issues that we're facing today.
And we will come into a lot of specifics a little later on. I intend to ask each of you, and Professor Walden Bellow has now joined us, and I will ask each of you for your specific intakes, including I'll be asking you, Dr. Tony Clark, about globalization versus deglobalization and where is free trade and global financing leading us. I'll be asking Dr. Jim Garrison the pending geopolitics of global warming and food shortages and mass migration and military conflicts, which in some instances are inevitable because we tend to always back the people who are in power, and they don't want to share the power. They don't even want some sense of equality in their own countries, and they assume that going forward in the future, that there'll be a status as we've seen in the past where tens of millions of people will simply stay quiet, I do not believe is going to happen. I believe we're going to see an enormous challenge in the seven leading hurt countries in the Eurozone, and we'll come back and ask you about that. But now let's go over and welcome Dr. Walden Bellow to our program. Nice to have you with us today, Dr. Bellow.
Hi, Richard. Yes, I'm very happy to be on the program. Let me just say, Richard, that there's an emergency meeting in the Congress, the House of Representatives, of which I'm a member right now, and I'll probably have to leave sometime during the program, if you don't mind.
That's fine. Richard's our producer. This is Gary Nall, and that's fine. But I'm going to start with you, so at least if you do have to leave, we will have gotten, hopefully, some of the best insight you have. Could you give us first your overview of where you believe that globalization, supported by both the Democrats and the Republican administrations in the White House and Congress, have gone wrong?
Well, I certainly would support the contentions by my good friend Tony Clark about globalization having gone off the rails. I think that this was from the 1980s and the 1990s on. This was sort of the push of global corporations, and neoliberals tried to justify this by saying that it was the most efficient way of organizing the global economy. And even at that point, from the 80s to the 90s, there was already a great deal of resistance to that, which took the form of battles against structural adjustment in developing countries, the whole anti-globalization movement, that emerged, especially focused on the World Trade Organization, and the whole environmental movement. And so this was always a disputed kind of project in which people fought each step of the way. So I would say that the crisis of globalization, corporate-driven globalization, came both because of its internal contradictions, that it failed, in fact, it failed to deliver the kind of prosperity it had promised the people. And I still remember during the World Trade Organization, the first ministerial meeting in Singapore, which I was able to attend, they were so triumphalistic that there would be no major barriers to global prosperity that they were announcing then. And three, and very important, is the resistance that dogged the people pushing globalization each step of the way, which I think the one of the high points, major high points of that struggle, was the mobilizations in Seattle, which really was the one that broke the World Trade Organization offensive. So I would say that, and I think this is really a point to emphasize, is that the Occupy movement is not something that just came out because of the crisis of 2008 and 2009, which persists up till today. But really, the Occupy movement is part of a process of resistance that really characterized the 1990s, especially the first decade of this century. So the point that I would just like to make, Gary, is that when we look at the what Tony calls the unraveling of global capitalism, I think we need to focus not only on the what we might call the objective contradictions of this process or its real inability to deliver what it promised, but also should factor into this the real resistance of people that in fact took place. So this was a defeat that came out of both internal characteristics of corporate-driven globalization, as well as someone that came out of the resistance of the people that it was trying to marginalize. So the sort of the point that I would emphasize.
Okay. Let me paint a larger picture. For 30 years, many of us, myself included, were writing articles or doing reports on how many jobs were being outsourced to other countries. If you remember, at one point it was Haiti. They were a close neighbor, and we were talking about how many jobs we were creating for the Haitian people without realizing how many of those jobs were being taken out of America. At one point, I did an analysis of just five individuals, T. Boone Pickens, Carl Icahn, Saul Steinberg, Ivan Bosky, and Michael Milken. Those five people were driving the corporate rating, and they were the ones buying corporations, loading those corporations up with debt, and then taking their profits, working with bridge loans from Wall Street firms, including Goldman Sachs. And then when the company had its most profitable division stripped off, their employees' benefits taken away, nobody was complaining in the mainstream media, and neither party, including the Democrats, were making this a major issue. To the contrary, the Clinton administration made NAFTA and GATT and the World Trade Organization major points of its why it should get reelected, were pro-union, yet everything they did caused, all told, now this is the figure I have, approximately 28 million jobs in a 30-year period. Now, of course, many of those people went from working in a good union job, making a living wage, to flipping hamburgers. So that said, today, everyone lines up to talk about how they're going to create jobs, and we still haven't changed the policies that are allowing this globalization, with its focus on free trade agreements and liberalization of trade barriers and restrictions, heavily focused on manufacturing, either the production of goods or the acquiring of resources. While today there is more resistance in some sections, particularly by developing nations, we are at the same time witnessing what appears to be a rise in globalized financing, particularly with the trading in commodities, which has been increasingly dramatically disadvantageous to the people where they're taking their diamonds or their essential minerals or soil, buying up land and throwing the people off their property as if somehow these people don't count. What do you see the long-term impacts, Dr. Bellow, envisioning that all of this rape of the people's environment, taking their resources, working only with their military or powerful leaders, both Democrats and Republicans, and not giving a hoot about how they're helping hundreds of millions, if not billions, of people who no longer have any form of sanctity in their own environments?
Well, you know, a number of the points that you raise are really, really quite important. First of all, I think the economists and the mainstream media, as you said, must take a big, big part of the blame, because even as you and I and Tony and others were already trying to push an analysis about how this process was going awry and was not delivering, they continued on in terms of their praise of globalization, despite the facts that they did not have the facts on their side. And I think in 1999, Seattle event was, I think, the big shocker for them. And I think since then, they began gradually to look at what we were presenting, and some of them to gradually acknowledge it, you know, that in fact globalization was heading the wrong way. So I would say that the media, the mainstream media, including the New York Times and others, must really be seen as having been part of the problem. The second thing is that they were saying that they were creating jobs in the developing countries by, say, bringing them to, say, Haiti and other places. Well, I think that this was really, you know, something that was not, in fact, happening, because, one, a lot of so many other countries, from Mexico to the Philippines and elsewhere, jobs were also being destroyed because corporations, American corporations in particular, were all going to the great labor nirvana, which was China. And so throughout the developing countries, there were not only from the U.S., there was transfer in.
Hello. I'm sorry, we had a lost drop call. We'll try to get him back. That's Professor Walden Bellow. Let's go over to you, Jim Garrison, in the interim. Pick up on this theme that, and let me put it in a little different context. One of Martin Luther King's most important speeches, at least for me, was his mountaintop speech. And there was a parable that he spoke about in there, where he and his wife were driving in Israel to a town that was near the ocean, below sea level. And it was not a long ride, about 13 to 15 miles. But it was a dangerous one. He was talking about how there was this story of there was a person injured beside the road, and someone was thinking about stopping and helping them. And then the concern became, but what if that person's not really hurt? What if they would hurt me? And, you know, the idea that why should I stick my neck out for a stranger? And then Martin Luther King shared an insight that has really kept with me, and I would like for you to start with this. He said, we should not always think about the consequences to ourselves, but what happens to the other person that needs help and we don't help them. And when you look in America, you're looking at the impact of globalization. You're looking at the destruction of the Glass-Steagall Act, trading in commodities essential to life, without any concern of what it means to the people who can't afford the fuel, the gasoline, or the heating oil, whose environment can be destroyed by hydrofracking, who are denying the virtues of and proper funding of renewables, and also people losing their homes. Why? Because frequently their jobs were lost. It wasn't their fault their jobs were taken overseas, but that was the economic model, and they had no say-so in it. And as a result, now they can't afford their homes because they don't have a living wage. And we're talking about 11 million homes being foreclosed or lost in bankruptcy or the proceedings in the last 5 years. That's 44 million people made homeless. But we don't think about them. We don't think about the 12 million hungry children that go to bed each night hungry and wake up hungry in the morning. That's in America. We don't think about 1 in 5 now in permanent poverty. We don't think about 100 million Americans, almost one-third of the population, living in dire straits with no advocates. We don't think about the 30 million senior citizens who are struggling and they don't have advocates and no one speaking on their behalf. And we don't see them. They're not marching. They're not demonstrating. So my question, going back to what Martin Luther King said, was should we not stop for a moment of just constantly thinking about what's in our interest and think what will happen to the person that we don't help and put that in the context of what will happen to all these people around the world who China and American hedge funds and Saudi Arabia and Kuwait are buying their land and forcing them off into the hundreds of thousands so they can use that land for themselves. What do we think of the outcome will be in Greece and Ireland, where we're taking away their meager pensions and many of their health benefits and other subsidies they have to give to the globalists, the people who are behind this, the International Monetary Fund and other organizations? What do we think is going to happen when we pepper spray protesters and put them in jail, or we make any just demonstrating in America a terrorist act by the FBI, who now says that those who go into people's property to report or show or film or photograph or report on abuses to animals in factory farming are now considered terrorists. And under the new law that Obama signed, those people could be rendered anywhere and arrested without a habeas corpus. So then my question, the large question, is a big question. Take your time, no rush. What happens when we as a country don't seem to be looking out for the interest of others in our own country, including our own children, versus children and people and families all over the world, as if there cannot be a consequence because we don't want to participate?
Well, I think you're hitting the nail on the head in terms of the fact that the national security state that has been in formation for some time and is in the process of real consolidation into law through the 2012 National Defense Authorization Act really turns the Good Samaritan motif really on its head. And I think that we're in a situation, which is the reason why I started my remarks at the beginning of the hour, with just this observation that rather than globalization being seen as something that's destroying the developing world, what we're seeing is those policies now are coming home to roost. And the litany of statistics, Gary, that you have just outlined are the tragic consequence of what happens to any country when the populace is swayed into sort of mindless consumerism, and we no longer pay attention to what Jefferson said at our founding, that the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. When the National Authorization Act was passed and signed by the president on New Year's Eve, most of the country was celebrating or watching TV in the celebrations at Times Square. And I would guess that probably less than 5% of the American public even knew that our most precious liberties codified in the Bill of Rights, whereby a citizen now can be picked up without charges, held indefinitely without a trial, executed if necessary without any judicial constraint, is now the law of the land. And I would just note that this these bills to kind of stop online piracy, as they're being called, supported by Rupert Murdoch and a slew of major corporations, will be providing the government with the same legal capacity on the Internet that it now has achieved on the citizenry. And, you know, and the question of what you do about that is something that I and many of the people that I am in conversation with think about all the time. And I think we're between a rock and a hard place. I think that the analogy here is really, you know, in some ways the Jews in 1930 with the rise of National Socialism. Democracy works when the institutions of governance continue to be porous and resilient to the will of the people. And at some point, when the instrumentalities of a national security state get so consolidated and so impervious to the will of the people, we have to really be careful about how we start to think about our government and the capacity of a people to transact social change. I believe that, particularly with Citizens United and the capacity of the major corporations and the 1% to put unlimited money into U.S. elections, the absolute pervasive fraud of the voting machines, you know, we no longer have democracy in America. And I think not only is the rapaciousness of globalization going on with very little public attentiveness, I think the collapse of our democratic institutions have also gone equally unnoticed and unattended. And I think that what just happened with Occupy is a very interesting episode. They flowered, and then over about a month period, in late November into the 15th of December, as everybody started to focus on the holidays, there was a national and very complete and comprehensive dismantling of all the Occupy sites. And it was coordinated not at the local level, but at the national level.
Homeland Security coordinated it.
Yeah. And what we're seeing activated now is the 600 FEMA camps, which will be activated all throughout this year. And so I think that we need to really understand the gravity of the crisis that we're in. One final note just on my side before Tony weighs in, because I think the situation in Canada with the Prime Minister and the government there is in many ways equally grim, is I believe that people need to really come together in community. We can no longer assume that just because we vote, we can gain the public will. I think that we're in a police state. I think that the police state is preparing concentration camps. I believe that we're heading into both ecological turbulence and financial turbulence, and it's going to be the capacity of ordinary people now to come together in self-conscious community. For example, I think it's important for people to start thinking about getting some kind of land outside of the major urban centers that can live and support a community off the grid. I think the transition movement, I think the permaculture movement, these are measures now that used to be marginal that I believe are emerging as central to any kind of strategic navigational strategy for someone who is both aware and seeks to, again, navigate through the turbulence that's coming because of the complete collapse of any kind of public good and the ascension of essentially monopoly capitalism. And just to recall Marx, Marx predicted all this. He says that when you get to the stage of monopoly capitalism, he says there is something in the system that will drive the entire complex into a spasm of self-destruction. And I can just see it coming as clear as day. And anyone who also sees it, I think, starts to take steps in a more of a self-protective capacity than trying to change a system that has shown itself to be impervious to any kind of democratic process.
I appreciate those insights. If you've just joined us, I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. It was 7.5 years ago that I founded the Progressive Radio Network, and with just a few people listening, today we are driving the progressive message out there with forums like this. And we thank those people, over 200,000 coming on last week alone just to download our program. So the message is getting out. So, and by the way, when you're listening to Dr. Jim Garrison talk about these issues, that we have become a police state, many of you will realize that you are not hearing this spoken on MSNBC. You will not hear Lawrence O'Donnell or any of the other people, Rachel Maddow, because they are a part of the new official Democrat and official liberal spokespersons. So they're giving us the point of view that the problems are all the Republicans, and hence the mocking Michelle Bachmann and the others on that end. On the other side, you have the official conservative and the official Republican institutions such as Fox and the Wall Street Journal and the New York Post and other publications, and people who are very popular, such as Sean Hannity and Glenn Beck and Bill O'Reilly and Laura Ingraham and Michael Savage and Mark Levin. And so what we have in America now is we have two groups of people, both official, both who are quoted, both who are invited into every major forum, the foundations that feed them, whether it's the Heritage Institute or the Cato Institute, and they have their sponsors. On one side are very wealthy philanthropic organizations supporting the MoveOn.org that supports the Obama administration and saying, Obama's not the problem. It's those bad Republicans. On the other side, you have the Koch brothers and over 420 different organizations and ALEC. And ALEC, of course, is meeting regularly, just met last week for 3 days with state legislators and telling them, here are the 800 bills that we want put through and laws we want changed. And then these people dutifully go back and don't talk about meeting with ALEC, don't talk about meeting with major corporations. They simply say, we want gas hydrofracking because it's going to bring in 275,000 new jobs into New York State, and we'll be able to have 77,000 new wells, and it'll be prosperous to the people, and it's safe. There's no impacts showing it's negative. So the public is reading this in the New York Times, but then we find out that everything those legislators are told about the hydrofracking for gas out of shale is coming from PR groups hired by ALEC that are representing those energy cartels and financial syndicates that are the new bubble. The newest bubble in America are the hydrofracking bubbles all over the United States. And indeed, there are multiple problems with the environment. So by the time we speak up, guess who doesn't want to cover our message? The New York Times gives it a little sidekick, MSNBC, to get on there to really take issue with this, especially if the issue involves challenging the administration. If we challenge them on their pick of Monsanto's top people like Michael Taylor to run food safety at the FDA, or Vilcek being head of the USDA, also a pro-genetic tech person, we're told we're not talking about that. If we talk about the million-plus people who have been injured or killed in Iraq and Afghanistan and the 4 million homeless and the consequences of depleted uranium, you won't find a program. You won't find one program anywhere in the official left media talking about the long-term consequences of depleted uranium that has a half-life of 4 billion years on the Iraqi people. You won't see the pictures that I have in my film on Iraq that of 5,000 deformed and cancer-ridden children, with the doctors saying, please let the American public know that the depleted uranium from all your weapons here are causing the most massive birth defect of anywhere in the world. Where is that in the American media? The left media, the pro-people, pro-democracy media, you don't have a word spoken. And then what you have, you might have Current TV, and they do a good job over there, by the way, I believe, outstanding reporting, especially on the Young Turks. And but where's Keith Urban's outrage and his great commentaries going after Obama? He'll have Nancy Pelosi and the very people who are part of the problem in supporting globalization on his program. Did that have anything to do with this $50 million contract over 5 years? I don't know. All I know is then, where does that leave people such as my guest who have an important point of view? Because the moment they say there are going to be concentration camps in America and FEMA, and we have the actual documentation proving this, then they say that must be some left-wing loon. Okay, set aside the name-calling. This is a man who has degrees in religion and theology from Harvard University, Cambridge University, major involvement in major forums, including president of the Gorbachev Foundation, and one of the founders of the State of the World Forum, one of the most respected institutions in the world, and co-founder and president of Wisdom University. You're not talking about crackpots. You're not talking about extremists. You're talking about people who are telling the truth, and we can handle this much truth. It scares us because the left and the right have come together officially. And if you don't join them, you're no longer left or right. You're no longer a historical conservative or a liberal. You are excluded from the conversation. You have no forum. Thank goodness there's this forum. So that's what we're dealing with. Now, that said, I want to go over to our other guest. By the way, we're not able to get, because of a storm, our guest back. But thank goodness he had a chance to share some of his points of view, Professor Bella. But Dr. Tony Clark, when you take a look right now, let's make this globalization issue very personal and very real. How long can globalization, including the unfettered interference of and manipulation in the global currency markets, where any big institutions and corporations and banks, if they fail, which they have, they're bailed out by either the European Central Bank or the Federal Reserve, $16 trillion, according to independent Vermont legislator Senator Bernie Sanders, $16 trillion was given to them interest-free, no collateral, no time limits on paying it back. And these, including hedge funds, equity partnerships, banks in America, banks, Citicorp got 2.1, Bank of America got 1.3. We weren't told about any of this, and yet not a single home was stopped from being foreclosed by executive order or by a mandate of Congress. Not a single interest was forgiven in late payments on college loans, which is now $1 trillion. Not a single late payment of up to 100% on debit cards or credit cards was given to people who are kiting almost $1 trillion in personal credit card debt. No one is helping the American public, small businesses, or the people who have something to say. Instead, it's more money to these people. How long do you think this can go before it all collapse? Your thoughts, please.
Well, it's going to collapse, and it's on the and it's already showing collapse everywhere. I think that what we saw with the wall, you know, there's been an attempt to try to dismiss the Occupy Wall Street movement, but I think that it's going to come back again with a real strong vengeance in 2012, and we're going to see a lot more shaking of those foundations. What we saw with the Arab Spring was also an uprising of anger over the dictatorship of capital. And I think it's really important. I want to go back, if I can, just for a moment, Gary, to what Jim was saying, and sort of weave that into what we're saying here. And that is that I think Jim is absolutely right in characterizing the emergence of a national security state. Clearly, the amendments to the Defense Authority Act and measures that were brought in, and also the amendments to the Patriot Act, are indications of now going over the top in creating a national security state. But what's also important is that this is being wedded with this stage of capitalism, so that we now have national security capitalism at work. And at the heart of that, as was the case with the monopoly capitalism, is a dictatorship of capital itself. And I think that this is what eventually people are going to start to put together in their own minds as they resist the bank bailouts that you were talking about, as people start to rev up during an election year in the U.S. and start to think, well, who really got shafted by this process? What's really going on here? Hopefully people will identify this for what it is, the dictatorship of capital itself. Now, having said that, we are also, on the other side, being faced with an avalanche of the politics of fear. And this is where the national security state apparatus starts to come into play. And herein lies one of the greatest problems that we're going to be faced with, and that is, are people going to be silenced? Are they going to be controlled, manipulated by the politics of fear? And that's what happens when you get caught up in this the Democratic Party versus the Republican Party dialogue and discourse. is that you get caught in that mess, and people, and it ends up becoming through creating a sense of fear in people's minds that they, that the only thing that's politically relevant is what's going on simply between what's happening in the discourse of politics between the Republicans and the Democrats. Therein lies the therein lies a real serious problem. We've got to create space for the continuation of this critique against the what I'm calling here the dictatorship of capital, and I think that that's going to be really, really critical. Jim also mentioned that we're faced with the same situation, or a similar situation, I should say, across the border in Canada, and we are. We've got a conservative government, mindset that's operating in government, but it's really exhibiting the same characteristics of the emergence of the national security state and its connection with the economic model, namely capitalism. And the two of these things are coming together in a form of national security capitalism that's having a serious impact. Let me just briefly refer to one example of this happening in a big way here in this country, and that is we have something called the tar sands. It's the biggest oil boom to be found probably on the planet right now in terms of increasing production of oil and delivery of oil, largely to the United States at the present time, but China also has entered into the picture. And what we're facing today is this is the largest industrial project on the planet. It will involve over the next 15 or 20 years something like $1.7 trillion of investment. But it's also the most environmentally destructive project on the planet. You put all this together and you realize that on the ground, people, you know, in the area where this development is taking place, which, by the way, is currently or will eventually be the size of the United Kingdom, an area that's just completely torn up in order to be able to get at the bitumen that lies beneath the sedimentary rock basin. And by doing that, you end up destroying a great deal of the boreal forest, which is the carbon sink in the northern parts of the globe. The second thing is it creates a huge amount of greenhouse gas emissions, and three times that of conventional oil. And thirdly, it ends up both depleting and contaminating the water system in that region, which happens to be one of the three most precious freshwater systems in the world. You put all that together, and you have got an ecological disaster in the making. But it's all done to deliver oil, in this case now, to the United States, and more recently, opening up markets in China. And so here we have a situation where the politics of fear that I was talking about before are really rampant in this country, saying that while the rest of the world is going to hell in a handbasket economically, we are saved by the tar sands. We are saved by this great oil boom that is taking place. Meanwhile, this great oil boom is creating ecological havoc. And so these are the kinds of issues that are wrenching many of us as Canadians here, because we have a government now that completely supports the export of this oil and the massive increase in production over the next 5, 10, and 15 years, all of which is contributing massively to the problems of climate change that we're facing today. So I just want to bring that out as an example of the struggle that's going on right now. And it isn't just a matter of economics and the financial system, but it really is a matter that's hitting all aspects of life, and particularly the environment itself. And this dictatorship of capital is really at the center of it.
Dr. Tony Clark, I appreciate those insights. Dr. Garrison, last year I was keynote speaker and on Equinox over to the UN, and here was a whole room, after we tolled the bell inside, filled with environmental groups, and I had a choice in that moment. I could tell them what I really felt, or I could, you know, tell them something to make them all feel good, and instead I just told him what I felt, and I said I believe that the environmental movement has been substantially co-opted because the foundations that are dependent upon money frequently are receiving now money from the big polluters. And the moment you get money from a big polluter, there's very little likelihood you're going to continue to go after that big polluter. And indeed, I gave examples of that to the group, and you could see people squirming in their chairs. And I said, the moment I saw Al Gore throwing football on the vice president's lawn with some leaders of the environmental movement, I know the environmental movement had taken a step towards being compromised. And so even some of the foundations that's supposed to be protecting us, that's leading the way, have compromised some of their values. There are others that have not. So now we have an environmental crisis on many different levels. There's all these 12 tipping points. Four of them are going to tip. Nothing is being done. We have the coldest day, the hottest day, the worst rain, the worst drought. 16 states are in permanent drought. The worst forest fires in American history in Texas, in New Mexico, in Oklahoma, in Arizona, and the second worst in California. We now have water wars going on because Lake Mead is going down. It had gone down 160 feet, came back 40 feet because of a good year, but that's temporary. And now California is going to be getting water where other places will not. It's against the law in the state of Colorado to go out and collect your own well water now off a cistern. We're not doing anything, and I repeat, anything that would fundamentally change how consumers are engaged in impacting the environment, governments impacting the environment. The number one polluter in the United States is the federal government, and it's in the military-industrial complex. Nor are we do we have the courage, even with the latest round of talks that were just a fiasco down in Durban, South Africa. Our United States representatives were there to make sure that nothing that committed America to a lower carbon footprint actually happened. So my question is twofold. One, with no real strength of political backing to stop the engine of massive pollution, as Dr. Clark was talking about, with oil and gas and nuclear, what are we to do? And do you see that it's likely that we will have to have an environmental major event before it even begins to register that we're actually connected to the environment? That's one question. My second question is this. Many years ago, I was invited by a close friend to a fundraising that they were having in their home on the Upper East Side. And this is a private townhouse. Their people are very wealthy and were strong Democratic and liberal supporters of causes. But it was for Bill Clinton when he was running for president. And in the conversations leading up, I said, who's going to be there and why are they there? And a very honest statement came out that really just floored me. My friend said to me, Gary, this really isn't about a better world or a better government. This is about people who are very powerful and very wealthy making sure that those federal contracts and those insider positions or those ambassadorships go to them instead of the Republicans. And I said, but are they qualified? What if they're not qualified to be an ambassador? What if their company is not a good company? He said, that's irrelevant. You're going to see people able to write checks for millions of dollars to get money for these people, and that's before the Citizens United. He said, that's all any of these fundraisers are about. And everyone knows that. And Clinton knows it. And he'll be doling out all kinds of promises disguised about, oh, that's what you're in. And I can assure you that the people around these people will be communicating back channel to make sure that when this White House is settled, the people who are going to be at every one of these important positions and all these contracts, they are all going to be from these people's supporters. He said, that's the way it works. I'm sorry that if you're too idealistic to see it, but it doesn't change no matter who's in the White House. And by the way, if it weren't for me and my friends giving money to a Democrat, it would be me and my friends giving to some Republican as long as we got the contracts. At the end of the day, it's who gets the contracts and who gets the positions that counts, not whether or not we have a better country for the American people. That really disappointed me. But that's the reality from someone who was in a position to see. I was there. I saw it. I saw the conversations. Your thoughts on both of these about take away, pull back the curtain in the Wizard of Oz. The gee whiz, the Democrats are pro-labor, pro-union, pro-poor, pro-environment, pro-helping the worker, pro-saving jobs. And the Republicans are, pro-military industrial complex, pro-war. Take away the curtain and show us the truth of what we're really facing now, in this moment and in the future, as well as the earlier question.
Oh, boy. Thank you, Gary. Once again, every time we get together like this, I'm just struck by your clarity and integrity of spirit, and I just want to acknowledge that. Let me take up your first point first, and just to say that starting with the tar sands, what Tony was describing has been described also by James Hansen, the chief scientist of NASA, as basically a game over event, not a game changer, but James Hansen has said that if the oil from the tar sands is released as the Canadian government expects, that will put so much CO2 into the atmosphere that essentially climate change becomes a runaway disaster. I think there's another equally profound occurrence that's taking place in the Arctic that was brought to public attention by a Russian scientist about a month ago. And that is that he measured plumes of methane coming directly out of the Arctic seabed, which is only 500 feet underneath the ocean surface there in the Arctic. It's very flat and it's very shallow. So as the polar ice caps have been receding because of global warming, the sunlight is melting the frozen seabed, and millions of tons of methane are spewing themselves up into the surface. Now, up until just about a month, 6 weeks ago, there were plumes of methane that were more like bubbles, and what he measured was a plume of methane 1,000 meters across. That's a third of a mile. And that over a 10,000 square kilometer portion of the Arctic Sea, he measured over 1,000 different plumes. Everybody listening to this program needs to internalize that between tar sands and the excavation of the dirtiest oil in the world and the plumes of methane, we're moving beyond situation critical. We now not only have a problem, Houston, we're on the verge of a global cataclysm, because the release of the methane by the millions of tons each and every day is going to radically destabilize the weather and the climate even further.
And Jim, the two are related. What's happening
totally
in the tar sands is definitely melting the tundra,
exactly,
which is giving rise to the methane. You're absolutely right.
Exactly.
And it's more lethal. Methane's more lethal as a greenhouse gas.
That's exactly right. So your kind of urgency, Gary, I just want to underscore that we're not in moderate times. We're not in liberal times where we can solve this thing incrementally. We've moved into a catastrophic system failure. We can see it in terms of globalization. We can see it in terms of the climate. We're seeing it in terms of politics. And what you were saying before, Gary, about this kind of politics as a diversionary tactic between MSNBC and Fox News and Rachel Maddow and Lawrence O'Donnell sort of on the Democratic side and Fox and so forth on the Republican side, just kind of, it's like badminton going back and forth. When the Senate was passing the Defense Authorization Act, Lawrence O'Donnell never mentioned it. And Rachel Maddow only mentioned it once after it was passed, and she did it as the last episode, for which she gave 3 minutes at the end of the hour. And so we're in a situation where the environment, the major environmental organizations have been bought off, and the situation is going into, I would say, a catastrophic system failure. Your point about Clinton and the fundraisers having spent a lot of time, I ran for Congress back in 1988 in Silicon Valley for the Democratic primary. I lost, but I entered into it with sufficient depth to know that what you're saying is absolutely true. And it's one of the reasons why I more and more, and I'm a guy who's been politically active since the Vietnam War and refusing the draft. I've been arrested at the Pentagon. I've committed civil disobedience a half a dozen times around nuclear power plants and environmental issues. I've been supporting Occupy. But as I look at the gravity of what's happening, I don't see any other recourse now than to begin to withdraw and realize that one has to begin to think about how one is going to protect one's family, protect one's community, and begin to develop some survival strategies for a world that is literally blindly going right off the cliff. I think we have probably 24 to 36 months before a major cataclysmic ecological event is going to shatter the world with such severity that major economic and political systems, I believe, are going to collapse. And I think millions of people are going to be destitute. And I think it's important for everybody who's aware and trying to pay attention in 2012 to understand that we are all extremely close to becoming statistics. And the only way for someone not to be a statistic is to connect the dots very, very ruthlessly and to begin to think through how one is going to survive a collapse of any kind of normal situation as we know it.
We're way ahead of that, Jim. We have written articles on the potential devastating effects of the solar storms coming. Are they coming? Yes. No one in the world, no astrophysicist, NASA even said they're coming. Is it going to be rough? It depends. If you believe some, they'll say, no, not a big deal. But what if they're wrong, as they were wrong in many cases? Then you end up with about 100 million Americans without any electricity and about 43 of the 104 nuclear power plants without power, and then you have Fukushima throughout the United States. You bet we're concerned. And then on the Pacific Rim, you have to look at the potential for that big one coming down that west coast from Alaska, clear down. And is it going to come? Yes, but we don't know when. But when you look and you say it can't happen here, well, then why don't you go and talk to the people of Fukushima and say, gee whiz, you know, did you all have, in some coasts, have a 68-foot tidal wave through here? Did it knock out your power plant? And even though you had water retaining walls, yes. Did you lose 28,000 people just in that few hours? Yes. And now is that still leaking plutonium? And yes, it is. So I'm one of those people who said, let us look at what is possible, plan for it without panicking, and do so with a calm and clear mind.
Exactly.
Because otherwise you're going to be affected by your own hubris. Gentlemen, we're out of time, and I thank you both for sharing your insights. Dr. Tony Clark and Dr. Jim Garrison, and I thank you, and for Professor Walden Bella, who was on earlier but lost our connection, we thank all three of you for sharing insights on the Progressive Commentary Hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Gary Knoll. Something to think about. Have a nice day.